My name is Jeff Berry, and I'm going to talk about using ultrasound to visualize the tongue during speech. So first of all, we might want to ask, why would we want to use ultrasound to look at the tongue anyway? So one of the main reasons is because there's evidence to suggest that there's a lot more than just audio processing during speech perception. So, for example, there's the well-known McGurk effect. So this shows that there's integration between the visual signal and the audio signal, at least during human speech perception. Okay, so here's a short video demonstrating the McGurk effect. So if you look at the lips during the video and you listen, then you'll perceive different syllables. So let's listen to that.
Ba, 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 ba.
Okay, so you should have, if you were watching the video, you should have noticed, you should have heard different sounds, right? But now if you close your eyes or look away from the video, if you don't look at the lips, I'll replay the video and you'll see that they're actually the same sound in acoustically.
Ba, 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 ba.
Okay, so if you're not looking at the lips, then you notice that the sound is always the same. It's always ba. However, if you look at the lips and hear the sound, then it changes. Okay, so this is a really strong effect, and it doesn't matter which language you speak; it's still you get this effect. At least most people do. So this really suggests that you know our brain makes use of lots of different information. So there's a recent study from a lab in Italy showing that there's also use of the motor system, specifically the part of the brain that controls the tongue and the lips during speech perception. But this, their effect is only observed during noisy speech. So what that means is that during a noisy situation, if you have trouble hearing the person you're listening to, that your motor cortex may become involved with helping you to parse the speech that you're listening to. So this has lots of sort of interesting questions to pursue, and we want to be able to use ultrasound to investigate what the tongue is doing during speech. So here's a typical ultrasound image of the tongue. I've added the profile of the face to sort of give you landmarks of what we're looking at here. So it's a mid-sagittal view, and the tongue tip is always to the right of the image. And some you can get as far back, depending on the subject and the probe you're using. You can usually get most of the tongue body. Sometimes the tongue tip is not visible, but you can definitely see the tongue body. So this bright band represents the surface of the tongue. So here's a typical segment of speech and what it looks like in ultrasound. Oops.
Pataka.
Okay, I'll play that again.
Pataka.
Okay, so you can see the tongue moving around to make the different sounds. So applications for this, there's recently been a new ultrasound machine been released that's handheld. So this is a fully operational ultrasound machine. And so there's possibilities in the future of having portable ultrasound machines integrated with other sensors to do speech recognition. There's also a large interest in silent speech interface, which is being able to measure some sort of articulatory motion without vocalization and being able to resynthesize speech from that. So this could be useful in an environment where it's either there's too much noise or if you're in an environment where you have to be silent, right, but you still need to communicate. And there's also the possibility of adding a model of tongue motion to a speech recognition system. So we can use these images to construct such a model. Okay, so in this work, we're just addressing these questions. So first of all, we wanted to classify tongue shapes into phonemes, and also use this to try to segment the ultrasound video into phoneme segments. So the tool we chose to do this is a variation of a deep belief network that we're calling the translational deep belief network. So a deep belief network is it's composed of stacked restricted Boltzmann machines. So restricted Boltzmann machines are probabilistic generative models. So a Boltzmann machine consists of a single visible layer and a single hidden layer, and so it's a neural network. And basically, in a deep belief network, the hidden layer of the first restricted Boltzmann machine becomes the visible layer in the second one, and you just stack them up. So these deep belief networks are typically trained in two stages. So the first thing that happens is you do an unsupervised pre-training stage. What happens is the network decorrelates the data. So it comes up, it learns a representation on its own without any human label knowledge. And then after that pre-training has been done, a second discriminative stage optimizes the network to output a label. So the human label is not actually added to the training until the second stage. So with the translational deep belief network, we wanted to add in the label during the pre-training as well. So this is the basic idea of what we're proposing. So we have a regular deep net, but we train it with both the sensor inputs and the labels concatenated to form the visible layer. Then we train a regular deep belief network, and then we copy the weights of the upper hidden layers over to a new network, and we retrain this bottom layer to accept only the sensor inputs without a label. So then finally we do backpropagation to add the labels on at the last stage. So I'll talk more about that. So the first thing you want to do is add you want to add the label data into the pre-training stage and that helps the network to build features that contain information about the labels and the sensor input. So the first thing we do is train a deep belief network on both the labels and the sensors, and then we replace the bottom layer of the network with a translational to accept the images only, and then we do discriminative backprop to fine tune the network. And then that allows us to extract a label from an unlabeled image. So again, to sort of explain this, we're just copying the weights from the original network over, and then substituting this bottom one with the new network that we trained. So to train this, we're using a slight variation on the contrastive divergence rule. So this is the equation for that, and what it says is you sample the input and the representation in the hidden layer. You sample from both of those to get reconstruction. So this is where the fact that it's generative, a generative model, comes into play. So you use the hidden layer to regenerate the visible output, and then use the regenerated visible layer to reconstruct another hidden layer, and then you minimize the difference between those. So here it is schematically. What we're doing is we're sampling from this layer to get our hidden units, and then normally you would just sample this to reconstruct this layer again. But the key difference here is we're sampling to a new visible layer that contains only the sensor inputs, and then sampling from that to get reconstructed hidden units. And then that allows us to apply the contrastive divergence rule. Okay, so for our experiment, we used just five phoneme categories. So we had a database of 1,893 images that represented prototypical shapes for those categories. So we went through by hand and hand-labeled where we thought the prototypical shape for the P, T, K, R, and L were, and we also chose images that represented a none category or a garbage category. And those were images that were at least five frames in the video away from a peak image. So then, to feed this to the network, we use this sort of labeling scheme where we have a one versus all representation, and we repeat that a bunch of times so that there's similar number of inputs nodes on the visible layer for images and for labels. That way the network doesn't just minimize the error for the label. It actually has to take that into account. So we have this. So if we had a category 2 or a T, the label would look like this. It would be, you know, the second one would be a 1, and then we would repeat this string a bunch of times. So then we took the images and scaled down the relevant part to a smaller number of pixels and did fivefold cross-validation. So we had dramatic differences in accuracy from a regular deep belief network and our translational deep belief network. So as you can see, on average, the standard deep belief network got about 42%. And when we add the label information during pre-training, we get a lot higher in the 80s. So we compared this to some other methods. There's been work on constructing what they are calling eigentongues. So they're similar to the eigenfaces of Turk and Pentland's work. This is just PCA analysis. So you put all the images. You have a set of images, and you find the principal components of that set of images, and then you can represent all your images in terms of the coefficient of the first n components. So we use that to do dimensionality reduction and ended up with 100, representing each image with 100 coefficients, and then use that to train a support vector machine. And that got 53% accuracy. We also used segment out part of the image. So by just tracing the tongue surface. So we have these ultrasound images, and instead of using the whole image, we just want to use what the human thinks is the relevant part. So that's just tracing the tongue surface. And in previous work, we showed how you can use this deep belief network to also extract these traces automatically. So, and I'll talk about that shortly. But so we use these features instead, just sampled these curves at 50 points and use that to train a support vector machine and got 70% accuracy. So the nice thing about the translational deep belief nets is they can also be used to do this sort of automatic image segmentation. So the way that works is using, again, the generative properties of the model to construct an autoencoder. So what that means is We first train a network up to just like before, but then we can use this top hidden layer to reconstruct what it saw on the input. So this is an autoencoder in the sense that what you put in, you can reconstruct on the output. So that means when we give it an image and a label, that we can reconstruct that image and that label. Okay. So we use this property to train an autoencoder like this. And then again, we create a new network by copying all of this piece over to the new network and then using this the TRBM to retrain a bottom layer of the network to accept only the image. So this allows us to put in an image and get a label out. In this case, the label is the tongue trace. So again, this is what our input looks like, is a reduced image, and put it into the network and it produces a trace. Okay. So the other thing we looked at was segmenting the speech sequence. So in this case, we used just a regular sequence, which included images that were not part of the original training set. So we only trained on just the prototypical shapes, and the sequence contains lots of transitional stages as well. So when we did that, the classifier, the deep belief network was, gives us a representation, or it gives us an activation that can handle multiple categories. So that looks like this. When we actually get, for the sequence, we sort of see the dynamics of the tongue motion, and we can use this to segment the speech stream. So for example, in this frame, we have activation for both the P shape and the T shape at the same time. So it's sort of transitioning from those shapes. And so putting it all together, we have the original ultrasound, the automatically extracted contour, and then here will be the label that it chose. And
Pataka.
It looks like that. Okay. So that's all I have. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Is there a question? Comments? No? Yes, please.
How robust is this training with respect to different speakers? Yeah. Thank you. You use a training set from one person or a couple of persons, and then you get a new tongue in the view, and there is probably a new geometry of its movement.
That's right. There's large differences between people. And actually, for the tongue surface extraction, we trained with 9 speakers, and it was able to generalize to new speakers as long as their tongue shape was sort of around about the same size as one of the 9 subjects that was trained. For the classification, we trained on 2 speakers, and it did well for those people. So that's still an ongoing area where we need to see how well it generalizes to other speakers. But you're right about that.
Thank you.
Okay, yeah. And the variability is mainly due to the shape of the tongue, or also to the way of speaking of each speaker?
I think it's mostly to do with the shape of the tongue, and especially during data collection, the depth of the scan and things like that make a large difference. So,
So maybe it could be normalized?
Yeah.
Halfway? Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Okay. Other question? No, so let's move to the next talk.